hello and welcome to the Wine Access Unfiltered podcast. It is no secret that I am a huge, huge champagne fan, and I think most of us are on the same page around champagne sort of being the king of the sparkling wine category, right? Like, we can all agree that when we think of sparkling, we say champagne. In fact, we interchange champagne a lot with other types of sparkling, but there are lots of other sparklings out there. And so today's podcast is solely dedicated to anything but champagne. Sort of play on this old anything but Chardonnay motto that we used to talk about that we're not talking about anymore because we did a whole episode on why we love Chardonnay. Chardonnay is a great grape and, in fact, often used in things like champagne and sparkling wine. But over the last few years, I've sort of come to this realization that in addition to the fact that there are other categories outside of champagne, it's not quite as hierarchical as we like to think it is. Like, there's not really a good, a bad, a better, a worse. There's just different categories, and they sort of slot in to different places in our lives. So, for example, if you go to Venice, like I just was with my guest who's with me today, you drink Prosecco, and Prosecco feels good there. There's a reason you drink Prosecco. If you go to places like Emilia-Romagna in Modena, you drink another sparkling beverage that's not champagne. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm gonna save that for later, but I will just sort of tee us up with, we've come a long way for those of you who remember the 80s commercials about it, the really bad ones that I honestly think should maybe make a comeback. We're going to talk about that. And to do that with me today, I've enlisted some professional help in the way of friend, wine expert, writer, Matthew Kaner is here. Hello, how are you?
Man, you can give me an intro any day. Hello there. Thank you. Doing well. Good to see you. It's been a while. It's been a couple weeks.
I love having guests on who I've recently traveled with. It's really kind of a selfish thing because I get to relive the experience. But also, I think there's so many things that when you're on these trips together, you see different things that I see. Like, we're all exposed to the same things, but our takeaways are different. So
true.
Like, before we get into the meat and potatoes of the podcast, like, we have to talk about this trip that we just went on because it was pretty extraordinary.
I'd say, yeah, from the moment we all saw each other in New York and got on the plane together until, you know, the water taxi from the airport to our hotel, which, have any of you listening, watching, ever had a water taxi take you to your airport or to your hotel from the airport?
I mean, come wild.
On. Crazy.
So crazy. I went to Venice when I was like 20 years old. I was in college studying abroad in London, and like for our fall break, we went to Venice, and I do not remember ever taking a water taxi. I remember a bus. I don't remember a water taxi, but I was also very poor. We stayed at a hostel. So it was a very different experience going with our friends at Mianetto, but it was a really cool experience because I didn't see it through the Prosecco lens, which is sort of how we experienced it. And I promise this is not to like brag about our trip, but it was like a really cool experience because it's so much more. Prosecco is so much more about the lifestyle than it is the wine. Like, we're excited about the wine. The wine is cool. But like, it really is. There's something about drinking Prosecco in the land of Prosecco on the water with your friends eating, you know, all the food.
Yeah. And Prosecco is analogous to a smile, a moment in time, watching the boats on the water, having a great spritz.
Yes.
Being in the hills, having great aperitivo and cicchette. Prosecco is so much bigger than just have a glass of sparkling wine. It really is. I love that about it.
And that this is my point about this entire podcast is like, champagne is champagne. Like, we're not going to compete with champagne because we don't need to compete with champagne, because there are moments like sitting on your deck on a beautiful day where like you just want something relaxing and easy to drink. And I think there are different these subcategories within sparkling wine that sort of fit those little positions in our lives. And you worked as a sommelier in hospitality for years, so you know exactly how this falls in, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would always have at the wine bars that I owned and was the wine director of, we'd have a champagne by the glass, but I'd always have either Cremant de Loire, Cremant d'Alsace, sparkling wine from Australia, sparkling wine from South America, sparkling wine from South Africa, sparkling wine from America. And then I'd always have a sparkling rosé as well that was non-champagne always. And giving people the option, what's funny about it is they just don't know the options out there until you make them aware of it. And that was, for me, part of the whole thing is you got to give the access for them to know it's part of what they can have.
Did you find that the reception to it was great? Or did you find that people just kind of universally were like, I'll just have a glass of sparkling or I'll just have a glass of champagne?
So to your point earlier, people will say, I'll have a glass of champagne, and they don't necessarily realize that that's a luxury thing. They think they're saying, I want sparkling wine. But what they're actually saying is, I would like something at a wine bar or restaurant that's at least $20 to $25 a glass. And that's not always what they mean to say. So we trained everyone to say, are you looking for champagne proper from the Champagne region or just something bubbly? It was a 100% a follow-up question that I trained all my people to ask, because the quality level you can get outside of champagne has risen so dramatically the last 20 years, depending on your budget, depending on your knowledge base, depending on, some people just can afford to drink Grand Cru champagne every day, you know, but not everyone can. So we don't want to take away the joy of someone having a great $12 to $15 glass of sparkling wine somewhere just because they use the wrong, quote unquote, wrong word. And I noticed a lot of people, when we would show them other things, other alternatives, a lot of the response would be, oh, I like this better than champagne.
Mm. Well, they taste different, right? I mean, even outside of the price of champagne, if you're talking about a Grand Cru champagne versus a Prosecco, like they're made to taste different. They're not made because one is more expensive versus less expensive. Like there is an obvious price difference, but one is really made to age and one is made to be consumed in its youth. And I think if you know that going into your drinking experience, it kind of like, I think it takes the pressure off in a lot of ways to not always feel like you have to have champagne or not always feel like you have to Prosecco. I think there's opportunity to have both at different times. And Lord knows this wine fridge to my right is stacked with so much champagne. But I also have a ton of other types of sparkling, ranging, as you said, Australian sparkling, Oregon sparkling, California sparkling, Prosecco, Lambrusco, which we're going to talk about. But before we get into that, we've got to talk about what is happening in the wine world. All right. So
things are happening.
You of all people know exactly what's happening because you've been, you are, what is your title at Ben's Journal? You're writing for them on the wine front, but I don't know what your title
is. Yeah. So my technical title is the wine correspondent. And so what I get to do is I run the wine channel on Men's Journal, mensjournal.com/wine. And I publish at least one article a day through the channel, mostly from my own work. I also have been able to bring in additional contributors and writers and awesome people who I meet on trips or I know them, their wine writing. And our whole point, you know, we're not the New York Times. We're not San Francisco Chronicle. This is more news-based and a little bit more topical, what's happening now, just because the way that people's attention span and bandwidth is, it's hard to get attention from people. And we're noticing they're reading a little less and less. So I've leaned into just trying to get great stories in front of people that are based on news and based on current events and based on what's happening now.
Well, what is happening now, according to our friend Karen McNeil, who's been on the podcast. She was actually episode one of this third season, and I love tremendously. And I think she always has something poignant to say. It's always well thought out. And I think this article sort of dropped a bomb when it landed a few weeks ago. It's called Nothing Left to Say, The End of Wine Writing. And it was something that she had sort of come out of this speech that she had given for the Walt Klenz Leadership Series at the Robert Mondavi Institute at UC Davis. And her contention is that wine writing is effectively gone. People are not drinking as much as they used to. There is, it's a lot of the same things that we've been hearing, right? Like Gen Z is not drinking, wine sales are down. In Bordeaux, there's vineyards being ripped up, and wine writing is not what it used to be. And I love that she breaks down the difference between a wine critic versus a wine writer, because they are two very different things. I highly encourage you to read this article, but I think my takeaway from this is, one, you know, Karen's a smart person. I think of all of the wine writers that have ever existed on the planet, she is the one that has really evolved and pivoted as times have needed. And you see this like on her social media, you see this in the fact that she, you know, she's a published author, she's written the Wine Bible, she is a, you know, she's won James Beard Awards. I mean, she's done it all, right? But she's also started a wine blog. She does a lot on social media. She does the video content, and she's really done her best to continue wine communication through all the different mediums that we have available to us. But her contention is that, like, we're in a very different place now. Wine writers are not getting paid what they used to. In fact, she cited an example in which she had talked with, I think, Newsweek about doing an article. And at the end of, you know, the conversations, she said, well, what do you pay? And they said, nothing. We pay absolutely nothing. And it was kind of wild because she cites, like, Decanter as being one of the last remaining publications that actually pays their writers. So I think, like, as a writer, I'm sure you have a lot to say on this topic.
So as a new wine writer, especially, you know, I had a 19-year wine career before I got given this opportunity. And I was uniquely positioned because I have a lot of relationships. I've traveled a lot. I've got a lot to say. And to Karen's point, I got this opportunity at a time when we're seeing dwindling readership. The numbers, like the amount of people reading, is not lower. It's literally how long they'll spend.
Right.
Sometimes we're seeing 45 seconds in engagement. 45 seconds.
Right.
And so for those of you out there who have watched, whether articles are posted on Twitter, LinkedIn, you know, Facebook, wherever you see links to get things, maybe in a tweet or in a, you know, in a text thread you have with your friends, it will show you the actual time that it takes to read the article.
Yeah.
Because people get to then decide, do I have the time to do that? And
yeah,
I started thinking about the psychology of it, and it all is based on the fact that socioeconomically, wine's getting more expensive. And traditionally, it's been a little bit hard to break into the younger, less, you know, pocket-heavy, wallet-heavy people. And now we're seeing the younger generation who have gotten probably a message that's not consistent about whether wine's healthy or not for them. So they're just not drinking wine a lot of times.
Right.
And that has trickle-down effects. And on the wine writing front, first off, is there more to say? Look, there's always more stories to tell. There's always things to highlight. There's always great things we can amplify. I think the void goes to who's reading it and are we wasting our time at times? And I've seen this where I can spend hours writing an article. I'm so excited to put it out. And then I get, you know, I see the analytics and I see how few people are reading it, and it's crushing, truly.
Yeah.
And all the points she makes about, you know, first off, there's little to no money in it. And I have so many freelance friends who they struggle month to month to make their rent and they don't know how much they can pull from certain publications. It's no one's fault. This is the scenario, but this is the world we live in now of wine writing, is because people aren't reading, it's hard for them to justify the spend. And places like Forbes and where I am at Men's Journal, it's all click-based and ad-based. So for all you out there, the more you click our Men's Journal articles, the more people might get paid. Contributors might make a living. But the same is true for publications like Forbes, and they're one of the biggest out there. So
right,
the model's shifting. And for Karen to get up there with the podium she's on and the audience she has to be able to, like, really get this information out, unfortunately, it's ripping off a Band-Aid and scaring a lot of people and probably exposing a lot of people who don't want to be exposed. But at some point, someone's got to make the statement, right?
Well, and I think it should be her. I think she's so well-researched, and she always has something to say. And it's always something that I want to hear, whether or not it's – maybe I don't want to hear it, but I need to hear it.
Yeah.
And I think – you know, one of the things that she says at the very top of the article is, like, you know, the ship is sinking and we're rearranging the furniture on the Titanic. Like, that is literally what's happening in the wine industry right now. Like, we are in this place, and we've been in this place for a long time. You know, I started on social media almost a decade ago talking about wine and also telling winemakers and telling wineries, like, hey, like, this is probably going to be a thing. Like, you can see it everywhere else in the world, like fashion, makeup, food, sports, like, it's all going to this direction. Like, you should, you know, look alive. And it just feels like the wine industry is just like, I just don't know. Like, I just feel like we should keep doing what we've been doing and that will just keep working. And the harsh reality is it's not working. The numbers keep telling us that it's not working.
Yeah.
And then we have the additional issue of, like, the World Health Organization talking about how zero alcohol is good for you, like, not even a drop to drink is good for you. You know, while the rest of us are like, all right, well, we're drinking in moderation. Like, we're not going to stop drinking. Like, it's not going to happen. Like, thanks, World Health Organization. But, like,
I'm not a doctor, but they're wrong. I'm just going to tell you, they're wrong.
Right.
They're wrong.
Right. You know, and I live in the world of social media, and she does talk about the wine influencer. Yeah. And I do think that this is sort of the new wave of the wine writer is the wine influencer. Like, are we doing what the wine writer was doing? Is it taking the length of time to research one article? Absolutely not. But I can put out content multiple times a day if I want to on various topics and have crazy amounts of reach. And I can also get paid to do that. And that's, you know, effectively how I support myself. So you know, as much as I respect her opinion, and she's not wrong, wine writers are not getting paid. Writers in general are not getting paid.
Yeah, it's all industries.
This is not
right.
this is not unique to wine. You know, I do have to wonder for those, you know, wine writers out there, like, you know, is it time to look at things a different way? Like, I love, there's someone working for Jancis Robinson who does, she talks to the camera and she gives like, you know, 3 or 4 articles a week. Her name's Samantha. If you want to follow her, she's great. I'll link her underneath. But she, you know, she just talks to the camera and she talks about what's going on. And it's like, it's nothing fancy. I've talked to her about it. She does a great job. But I think it's, you know, she's still managing to get the message across. And I just think that if we can just shift a little bit, it would go a long way. And you do it too. I mean, you always put all of your articles out on social media. And I think that really helps because I'm clicking through.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's an interesting balance of not everyone's willing to put themselves on camera and be out there and have, I mean, there's, I'm sure you see it in your comments, whether you're writing the greatest or rather putting out the greatest video, there's haters, there's people who have negative comments that throw out there, tell you you're wrong,
yeah,
challenge things that you've decided to put out. And, you know, I get the same with the writing stuff. It's a hard world to put yourself out there as a content creator,
yeah,
in any way. But the truth is the world we're living in now wants a short, quick bite video that they can learn from, pull from, and then be inspired to go learn more if they're inspired to learn more from.
I couldn't agree more.
And you've been amazing at that. You've done such an amazing job of that. No, it's so true. And people who are effectively communicating the way that maybe wine writers were 15, 20, 30 years ago are people who have moved to the video format.
Mm.
I've had great advice from friends of mine who have had success in that world. And for me, the issue has been, I'm not good at doing it myself. I don't like sitting in front of a camera by myself, getting inspired to have a script written and then edit it all. It's not who I am.
Yeah.
And I've had times in my life where I have luckily had the film crew and an editing team, and I've been blessed. And also now I don't have it. So it's hard to go back and kind of start from square one. But those who are the best at it, the most effective at it, don't let that be a challenge, like yourself. I mean, your content's incredible.
Thanks. I mean, it never feels normal.
Right. No, of course.
All right. Something for all of you guys to get excited about is the wine that I am about to open and enjoy. I'm not going to have it with pizza because I'm recording a podcast, you guys. But if you are joining us on our podcast Wine Club Adventure, i.e. if you're a member of the Wine Access Unfiltered Podcast Wine Club, the longest name for a podcast wine club in wine club history, please grab this bottle of Lambrusco. We're having Lambrusco today. This is the Fattoria Moretto. I'm going to open it when we get back in a second. If you haven't done that already, you will notice that there's going to be a little pop when you pull that cork. So stay with us. And if you're not a member of the Unfiltered Podcast Wine Club, well, now is your cue to do that. All the information is below. We'll see you when we get back with all things sparkling. All right, you guys, as I said, I've got the Lambrusco with us. I have waxed poetic far too many times about Lambrusco in this podcast. And finally, when we started talking about this season and all the different shows we wanted to do, I was like, if Lambrusco is not part of this podcast wine club, I'm out. Done. Thank you very much. See you never. Truly, I really wanted a Lambrusco to be part of it. However, the issue is the quality of Lambrusco is all over the place. So to find one that we could include in the wine club was a little bit of a challenge. So I went back through my archives of like everything that I've tasted. There was one in particular that I remembered having when I was up in Mendocino. Have you been up to Mendocino?
Yeah, but not in a while. It's been a few years. I'm going to get back hopefully soon.
I was staying up there and I went to this pizza shop, and the hotel that I was staying at actually had a little wine shop in it. And I was like, oh, we're going to have pizza. It would be so great to have Lambrusco. And this was actually, and I'm having trouble opening it, this was actually the bottle that I ended up having, and I had never had it before, but I did what I always do. And Matthew, I'm sure you do the same thing. I turned it around. I checked to see who imported it, and it was Kermit Lynch. And I was like, great, I am probably in fantastic hands. And as it turned out, I was. It was delicious. It was wonderful. It was bone dry. But for those of you who are unfamiliar with Lambrusco, we have some things to talk about. Matthew, since you do not have this wine, you have a different wine. Which one do you have with us?
Yeah, so I brought a producer who was the first Lambrusco producer I got obsessed with, but a whole new take on it. So this is Medici Ermete called Fermento. And this is more a Frizzante style, which we can get into kind of what the world has expected from. Because, look, there's what Lambrusco is. There's what we expect Lambrusco to be. There's been a disconnect between what's available in the United States versus what they've been working on in the amazing parts of Emilia Romagna. So I don't know what style you're having, but I'm guessing it looks a little more on the red wine style, a little more dense. We're about to find out. Yeah. So
it is.
What clone is that?
Grasparosa. So it's Grasparosa. Yeah. So we have so much to unpack with Lambrusco. We are going to talk about lots of different sparkling wines. So don't worry if you're not a Lambrusco fan, you're about to be converted. But also we're going to talk about lots. Lambrusco. We are in the region of Emilia-Romagna, as Matthew already said. This is in the north of Italy, kind of a long province that stretches east all the way at the border, almost to the western border. And at the north part, you've got like Milan, Verona, and Venice kind of stretched across the top. And then underneath of that, on the south part, you have Tuscany. So it's sort of wedged in between those two big regions. And what's super interesting about Emilia-Romagna is that despite being wedged between like basically Piedmont and Tuscany, Italy's two most proud regions for making wine, Emilia-Romagna is not really a place known for winemaking. It's known for two other pretty famous things. In fact, two of Italy's greatest exports, which are cars and food. If you've ever visited the region, you know that it's a beautiful place to visit. You've got Modena, you've got Bologna, Parma, of course. But wine is not really at the center of the culture. Wine is really meant to serve as the vehicle by which you continue eating, which you do a lot of in Modena. And Lambrusco is the beverage of choice. I assume, have you been to Emilia-Romagna?
Yeah, I've been a lot. I've spent a lot of time there. I'm quite a fan. I've been to the northwestern part, which is where Modena and Parma are. I've spent a little less time there. I've been to Bologna multiple times. And then I've been mostly in the kind of on the King's Road down toward the Adriatic in Cesena and Cesenatico and Forlì and where the Sangiovese di Romagna and Albana vines are. So like, as your point was put, it's not known for wine the same way, but there is really great value, really great Sangiovese, really great Albana is this kind of golden colored, a lot of skin contact happens with it, white wine. And then Lambrusco, depending on the style, it's just, I want to drink it all day.
And it's easy. I mean, mostly easy to do. I will say when I went to Lambrusco last year, it was for World Lambrusco Day. I think I've talked about it on the podcast. This was the one where they like flew me to Paris and we did the whole thing on the Eiffel Tower. Ooh. And then the following day, we flew to Bologna and then spent some time in Modena. And when we got there the first day, they're like, we have 165 Lambruscos for you to taste. Yeah.
Saw a range of quality, I'm sure.
Ranging in quality. And it was at like the Consortio building, right? So we're like, you know, kind of in this like classroom style. There's five of us. And they're like, you don't have to taste all of them. And one of the girls, God bless her, she was like, no, we want to taste all 165 Lambruscos. And they were like, really? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, all right, well, let's just do it. It was an aggressive amount of Lambrusco to taste. I will just put, like, tasting that many sparkling wines of any kind is a lot. But then when you're talking about wines that also have residual sugar and like tannin, it's like a recipe for disaster. My teeth have not recovered. Let's just put it to you that way. Like they are still stained from this adventure. But what I learned was there's so many different styles of Lambrusco than what we know. So we kind of have to back up a little bit. After I give you a little history of Lambrusco, we have to talk about this producer because it's actually a really interesting producer. We have to talk about something that you're probably too young for this, and I'm too young for it. But I assume you know about like the whole Rianiti deal.
I haven't thought about it in a while.
Okay, so back in the 80s, you know Rianiti, R-I-U-N-I-T-E,
yep.
Rianiti on ice, so nice. That was like the jingle. This is like a very big thing in the 80s. It was a super super popular wine. It was like one of the most popular wines in America. Unfortunately, what happened was they found trace amounts of diethylene glycol, which is a major component in antifreeze. So not super delicious. Anyway, they found a little bit of that in about 1.2 million cases of the wine. And so they had to have a huge recall that resulted in like 10% of the company's total sales. And so it kind of like gave Lambrusco a really, really bad reputation. And in some ways, it hasn't recovered. Like we still think of Lambrusco in the same way that we think of these like basket Chiantis in some way, kind of similar to like the Austrian wine scandal.
I was just about to say.
It was a very similar ordeal. And in fact, the whole reason that they tested this was because there was all of these things that were happening with like diethylene ethyl, whatever it's called, getting into the wine. Anyway, they have since made things right. But as a result, Lambrusco has really, really fallen out of fashion. And in my opinion, I think is one of the most delicious, exciting, food-friendly wines on the planet. One thing that champagne cannot do is go with a red sauce pizza and Lambrusco can.
True.
And that is, I will die on that hill all day.
I like that.
This is a producer that's been doing it for a long time, organically farmed. And as we pointed out earlier, you're going to see on the front of this, it says Lambrusco Grasparosa di Castel, I can never say this, Castelvetro,
si.
Castelvetro. Grasparosa is the, so Lambrusco is a family of grapes, right? So there's 12 different varieties within the Lambrusco family. And then you have like all of these DOCs, and this is one of them. So when you see Lambrusco Grasparosa di Castelvetro, generally this is going to be a darker Lambrusco, a little more tannin, a little more structure, right? But you could also have like Lambrusco di Sabuara or Lambrusco di Salamino, my least favorite of them, but they do exist. And they could be anywhere from white to rosé to red. There's so much to unpack here, Matthew. Yeah. What do you have to say?
Yeah, I mean, you have Grasparosa and I have the Sabuara. And for the most part, I mean, these are...
Oh, you do? Can I see it again? I didn't get to see the color of it earlier.
So the label is a little...
Oh, yeah. So it's like... yeah, it's kind of this like pretty like it's a violet-y, pinky... Oh, it's more like fuchsia. It's like a fuchsia color. It's a little bit more like see-through. Yep. Not quite as like this looks like... Mine looks like a red wine. Yours looks like a dark rosé.
Yours is opaque and mine has... I can see my finger and my hand through it, but... This is a style. So this producer that I'm having, the Medici Armette, they're 150 years in, five generations deep. And this was a callback to the way it used to be, going back to the method ancestral. So trapping unfermented wine basically in a bottle and allowing it to continue fermenting, Petnat style, kind of what we know today. Mm-hmm. And that has been, while it was maybe what they were doing 200 years ago, it has not really been the way they've been doing it. As far as I understand, they've been using autoclaves and adding their own ferment. CO2 the same way we saw in Prosecco. You don't see a lot of bottle conditioning there. Some people are doing it, but it's just not as common. Mm-hmm. So with red wine style, which Lambrusco tends to be in our, it's always meant to be quote unquote frizzante, not sparkling the same way champagne or Prosecco is. But the culture, and this is what I said earlier, like the culture of what people want has changed actually what they're doing in the production. And now like even my Petnat style is really sparkling, super sparkling.
Mm. Yeah, you got lots of bubbles on top there. Yeah,
how much bubbles did you have in yours? It didn't seem like it was that much. Not as much as mine, at least.
So, yes, interesting. I didn't get to see what the closure was on yours. This is like a straight-up cork that you pull out with a wine key. Yeah, you had a crown cap. And so you'll see lots of different closures for Lambrusco because Lambrusco, unlike some of these other regions that we're going to talk about, you can make Lambrusco pretty much however you want. Like it can be made in the Champagne method. It can be made in the Charmat method. It can be made method ancestral. It really like runs the gamut. There is no like quote unquote wine law that dictates how you can make Lambrusco. Like even within the DOCs that, you know, say how much Sabuara or Grasparosa has to be in the blend, it actually doesn't really dictate how you can make the wine. And so for that reason, and I think this has also been a huge issue with Lambrusco is like, there are so many styles and they can range from bone dry to super, super sweet. And the other issue is like I walked into the PA State store the other day because we were going to have pizza and hoagies, right? Which is like all I want is Lambrusco with pizza and hoagies. And I'll tell you why in a second. We walk in the State store and like, hey, do you have any Lambrusco? And they point me to this wall and literally all that is on the wall are like seven different formats of Riuniti. It's like jug form, magnum form, box form, little wine form. That's all it was. And it was one type of wine in multiple different forms. And I was like, well, shit, no wonder nobody is into Lambrusco because this is like, you know, this is like a whole state's worth of what they've got. And so you do have to do a little bit of digging and it does require, you know, someone to kind of like guide you because you don't always know what you're going to get into. Like I said, with the Grasparosa, you can, especially like this particular one, you can almost guarantee that the quality is going to be a little bit higher when it's Grasparosa di Castelvetro. But then when you get outside of that DOC, it is a little bit of a, you know, you got to ask some questions to get there. But they're saying this is bone dry. I think there's a little sweetness on this, but it's like a nice amount of sweetness. It's 11.5% alcohol. And the reason I like it with pizza and hoagies is one, pizza sauce tends to have sugar, which like a little bit of sweetness to it, like depending on where you go. Also, the dough can be a little bit sweet sometimes. And for that reason, I like to have a tiny, tiny amount of sweetness to go with that to kind of like match it. And I want acid, which is coming from the CO2. So I like to pair pizza with that. But the other reason that I like to do with hoagies, especially if you go to somewhere like Steaks Westchester, shout out to them, they use like real prosciutto and real like really good meats on theirs. And if you go to Modena, all you're going to eat there, if you don't go to Osteria Francescana, all you're going to eat there are plates and plates and plates of charcuterie. It is like, it is the capital of charcuterie land. And they're going to give you a glass of Lambrusco to go with it. And to me, it is like one of the great, like I'm still recovering from this trip that I was on because it was so much charcuterie, but like one can only have so much salami, but it was delicious. And like that salty meat with like high acid and tannin and sweetness, like what a delicious combo.
Yeah, mine's 11.5% alcohol, 7.6 grams per liter of acidity. It's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, it's up there. Doesn't the tech sheet doesn't say the sweetness, but I'm guessing residual sugar is probably 3 to 4 grams per liter. Just otherwise, it wouldn't be as balanced as it is right now. But mine's, you know, more on the rosé side. Not a lot of skin contact and maceration. I think, you know, again, to see the color, this has a lot of really amazing red fruits. It's a little floral on the nose. This would do quite well with a pizza, do really great with some, I really loved aged Parmigiano Reggiano. I think it's when you get the crystals, that's some of the best cheese on the planet. I love it.
Yes. You guys, I'm telling you, charcuterie, cheese, pizza. Like if this is all you eat during the summer, like I do with the occasional salad,
yeah,
Lambrusco, just stock up on it. It's so good. And I'm really, really excited that the team like at Wine Access and I got together and I was like, I really want this wine. And they were like, yeah, great. Amazing. I'm so excited because I feel like this is one of those wines that I can't always find. So I'm excited this is in the shipment. Also, another producer that we should definitely call out, and I'm sure you know this producer, Matthew, is Paltrinieri.
Yeah, very good.
Completely different style than what we're talking about. This is like, it's very small production and he really doesn't work with, I mean, he works with Grasparosa, but it's not, you're not going to see a lot of like the dark inky colored ones. He does a lot with the lighter styles. So he does a lot with like the Salamino and a lot with the Sorbara, but those are really beautiful. And those are all for the most part bone dry. And they would remind you of something that you would get like a true pet nat style. They're a little funkier. They're definitely not what you think of when you think of Lambrusco. But I think this stigma around Lambrusco is really falling by the wayside. Aside from the fact that you're still walking into the PA State store and seeing Riuniti, like mostly what you're seeing at restaurants anymore, if they're putting Lambrusco on the list, it's because it's a quality producer. Like you rarely see garbage out there. And doesn't Scarpetta like makes a Lambrusco in a can too, right?
They do. Yeah.
Yeah.
They do.
Which is kind of delicious.
Yeah. Look, I'm a big fan of Bobby and Lachlan and their team and all the things that they accomplish. And, you know, to be a Friulian producer, but also making Lambrusco is pretty cool.
I love Lambrusco. I was reading the, you know, some of the soil types, and it's like this one in particular is like, I was reading it to my fiance and it was like clay, like heavy soils, very rocky. And I was like, what does that sound like? Cause like outside here, I've just been working in the yard all week and it's just like heavy clay, rocky soil. And I was like, see, we could plant like old Lambrusco vines here and we could make Lambrusco here in Pennsylvania. So
you could,
you never know. Maybe we could. He was like, it's in high elevation. I was like, don't worry about it. It is high elevation, but don't worry about it.
Yeah, I love it.
Anyway, so that's Lambrusco. I love Lambrusco. If you have more questions on Lambrusco, DM me. I'll talk to you about it all day. It's so good. We'll keep drinking this and circle back to it. But we have to talk about what I would sort of consider, and I never really considered this until we went to Venice and started drinking it, because, you know, the way that Lambrusco is sort of a lifestyle, Prosecco is very much a lifestyle. You know, it's not a wine that we talk about. The tech sheet's a lot about, we just kind of drink it and it's easy and it's there. Prosecco, made from the Glera grape coming from the Veneto region, and sort of similar in that it's a lot of these like small plots of vineyards, like these little family hamlets that are speckled throughout. And you have like little, you know, portions of the region that have higher quality vineyards like Cartizze. But Prosecco, you know, is not champagne, as we pointed out earlier. It is made in the Charmat or Martinotti Charmat method, which means that unlike champagne, where that secondary fermentation is happening in the bottle, you're getting the contact with the lees. That's having that autolytic characteristic come out. So that's where you're getting that brioche, toasty croissant thing in champagne. You're not getting that with Prosecco. Prosecco, it's done in a tank. It's immediately racked off of anything that would be on there to give it that toasty character. And it's done in that way to retrain freshness and fruitiness and vibrancy, and it's intended to be drunk young. You're rarely going to see a vintage on a label of Prosecco unless it's rosé, unless it's like a very special single vineyard Prosecco. And it's really done so that you can sit outside add some Aperol if you want to, make an Aperol spritz, and just have it with some cheese. I mean, what else do you need?
And you touched quickly on the rosé thing. I mean, the rosé is a brand new revelation for them, I think, in the last 3 years. It's literally just got approved for them to be able to make rosé and have red varieties go into the wines. They're evolving. So our hosts were Mio Netto, and they're a curious one because NRA, who's their CEO of the company, was literally the guy showing up in New York 25 years ago with a briefcase full of information on Prosecco and wines to show people in New York. And America had no context for it. We didn't know what it was. Mm. He did the hard work, did the door knocking, did literally the like traveling salesman pitch. And 25 years later, America's the biggest market for Prosecco on the planet. It worked.
Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's amazing. That's why Mio Netto, the orange label is so iconic and so intertwined in like a smile and an orange bottle of Prosecco. For me, I'm kind of orange myself. So I love it. It fits my color palette. But they really are part of the American story of Prosecco in a way that you can't really escape. And also Aperol and just the spritz style being from Venice, it's such an amazing thing. We were, while we were there, they were showing us their aperitivo, both the alcoholic version and the non-alcoholic version, which is about to launch very excitedly. And they have an alcohol removed sparkling wine as well. They're literally making the choices for people, regardless of, am I drinking alcohol or not? Mio Netto and their team smartly are trying to have everyone kind of part of the conversation. And we're seeing Prosecco brands know that because they are a lifestyle brand, because they're a party wine, because it's something you sit by the pool, it's not necessarily a wine that you buy a bottle of and sit and age for 20 years, like maybe some champagnes. They really do want to be the every person wine. And me as a wine bar owner in the past, I would always have Prosecco because we could use it for happy hour. We could get someone a great $10 to $12 glass of Prosecco. It wasn't that investment someone had to make to get the more expensive stuff.
Right.
But the truth is, there are some really great wines. And you talked about Cartizze. We went there to the Hill of Cartizze. And these are some of the most coveted grapes in all of northeastern Italy. It's unbelievable.
The most expensive real estate in Italy, wine real estate in Italy, which is wild. What they say, like it was like a million an acre or something.
I think 2 million actually. And
2 million.
And before anyone gets all upset and starts, keyboard worrying about this, the reason why they're able to say that and it be true is because literally no one is willing to sell. So in order for you to to get someone coaxed into selling, you'd have to offer more than they're selling in Barolo. Otherwise, no one would sell.
Yes. And it will say it on the label. Like if you, and Mio Netto does make a, single Cartizze bottling, it'll say it like right across there. It'll say Cartizze. There's many different Cartizze bottlings. And there are like single vineyard bottlings, like Bisol 1542, like makes some beautiful ones as well. And when I'm at Aspen Food and Wine in June, if you happen to be there, I will be featuring both Mio Netto and Bisol in my seminars alongside lots of different sparkling wines, because I think it's important to see how these wines can play different roles in your life. Champagne is champagne. Prosecco is Prosecco. They do different things. You don't wear a cocktail dress to go farming in your yard. You don't wear jeans to a gala. They do different things. And that's a good thing. We need wines to fit different places in our life. And for me, Prosecco is that summertime wine where you're just sitting outside. You have a cheese board, your charcuterie. You just have something simple and easy. And like, Matthew, I don't know about you, but usually when I'm on these wine trips, I'm like, I'm wined out. Like, I don't want any more of whatever we've just been drinking for the last like 5 days. I got home and I craved a glass of Prosecco and an Aperol spritz. That's never happened.
It's uncommon for me to get sick of sparkling wine and or Aperol spritz. I love them. I could drink Aperol spritz all summer. And the only reason why it was a little hard for me to do exactly what you did was I got home. Was home for one day and then went straight to Houston, Texas for a whiskey event. Oh. So I all of a sudden had to shift into a whiskey mind for a day. And then I just was back in Texas for the Buffalo Gap Wine Summit, which was awesome at Perini Ranch. And so we were drinking a lot of red wines, as you can imagine. But I'm a fan of Prosecco in a way that I didn't used to be, because I think I was evaluating it from a sommelier mindset and not necessarily it's easy to do. Like we can say, well, it's not champagne. It's not Cremant de Loire. It's not, to your point, what you said, they're allowed to be their singular home and their own thing. And Prosecco DOC is a totally different thing than Valdobbiadene or Conegliano or Cartizze. They're not the same thing individually within the same region. So I think if we allow it to have its own personality, to be fresh and lively, and to have these moments in our life, again, by the pool, by the waterside, in a spritz, and stop being so kind of nose up on it, like, it's just allowed to be delicious.
I love that Prosecco, like, knows its place. They're like, no, we know that we're your jeans in your closet, and we're like, we're happy to be the Levi's. Like,
yeah,
it's all good. Like, y'all, everybody else who wants to give you a champagne, like, go for it. But we're going to do our own thing over here. Speaking of other things that compete with champagne, because we have to talk about other categories that do compete with champagne, there are other regions that will do Charmette method, Prosecco style, Lambrusco's, well, not Lambrusco style, but definitely Charmette method outside of the region. But these are the two places that you're going to find them. But what you do have are lots of other places that are sort of emulating the champagne style, making the wines in that traditional or method, Champenoise method. So they're doing that secondary fermentation in the bottle. Even within the region of Italy, within the country of Italy, you have other places that are making champagne-esque wines. Franciacorta, of course, being one of them. Trento Doc being another. I know you and I talked about visiting the Ferrari producer up at Villa Margon, right?
Oh, yeah.
Those are two places that you should definitely – yeah, those are beautiful, beautiful places. Franciacorta in the Lombardy region, you know, really making sparkling wine in that champagne method using predominantly Chardonnay, a little bit of Pinot Nero, and I think a little Pinot Bianco as well. Is that right?
For sure.
What's really interesting about these regions is that they are still making wines in this method. But I find with Franciacorta, there's incredible value there. One, the aging requirements are like crazy, especially as compared to Champagne. Like, for example, your non-vintage is a minimum of 18 months on the lees that it has to be aged. If you have the Sauternes, it's a minimum of 24 months for non-vintage, and even more than that for vintage. I love that you put up the Cadabosco, which is one of the, you know, the most famous Franciacorta producers, and they make a beautiful cuvée called the Anna Maria Clementi that I'm a huge fan of. If you see it on a wine list, like, beautiful, that's wine. Definitely one to order.
All-time wine.
Beautiful wine. I had actually had it about this time last year with another guest of ours and two other guests, Anthony Giglio and Ray Isle, when we were at the Kentucky Derby. Ray was the one who introduced me to it. He was like, oh, we should order this. And I had never had it. It was beautiful. But they are Trento Doc and Franciacorta, two separate regions. Trento Doc being, you know, sort of in the Dolomites, right? So you're at elevation, again, very Chardonnay heavy, making wines in that Champenoise method. Those are emulating the champagne style and get pretty close. If I'm, you know, I'm not going to overstep here and say they're the same thing, but they do get pretty close. Are you a fan of both either?
I love both. So I've been luckily able to visit both Franciacorta and Trento Doc. I've been to Cadabosco. I've hung out with my friends at Ferrari multiple times. And also I want to mention kind of on the same quality level and in the same mindset, Contratto in Alto Piemonte, you know, what Giorgio Rivetti and his team did when they bought the winery, I think in 2012 or 2011, you know, this is a sparkling wine producer that's been around actually longer than Ferrari, which they're from 1903. I think Contratto was the late 1800s that they were established. So Italy has a long tradition of making sparkling wines on that level, that quality. And we don't necessarily think of it as a champagne alternative. When you're in Milan, you're drinking champagne. But if you go to Venice, if you go to Bologna, if you go to other cities, like, champagne is not as commonly found.
True.
I haven't really been to Rome yet. I'm curious to see what the culture is like in Rome for sparkling wine. But like the kind of huge, well, I guess when you're in Alba and in the villages of Barolo and Barbaresco, you're more likely to see Alto Piemonte sparkling now. But Contratto has this a long history. They were originally one of the wines of the Queen of England for a long time. They have a rosé that was made for the Queen. They've got their, you know, I can get into a lot of history with them, but they've been around a long time. Cadabosco has been around since the 60s. And Anna Maria Clemente being the matriarch and the homage to the woman who literally made the choice to take her home and turn it into an amazing vineyard and plant Chardonnay and Pinot Bianco. And that choice that was made now ripples through. And the DOCG there, I think, came in the 80s. That winery's had their hands in all of it. And Trento Doc, would Trento Doc be what it is without Ferrari? Which, we're not talking the cars, guys.
No.
We're talking, so they actually have this interesting statement they make that the sparkling wine Ferrari, Trento Doc, is the masculine Ferrari, where the car is the feminine Ferrari. I know we're trying to get away from masculine, feminine in wine, but they still are able to say that because these two amazing family names with Enzo and then Giulio Ferrari from the sparkling wine producer. You know, these guys were basically disrupting their industries from an early time. And both of them mattered, and that name matters in two different industries. So crazy that that's the case.
They do pour the Ferrari at F1, even though they're not technically related. They do pour the Ferrari at
F1. No, Ferrari is the official sparkling wine of the winner's circle now for F1. Nice. So they have a specific, and you can go to one of my Men's Journals articles and read all about it back from last year when it all went down. They make a magnum only that whoever wins in the top three people for each F1 race get to use a magnum of specific for that event Ferrari sparkling wine, which is pretty cool. Trentadoc.
So cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're, I mean, Trentadoc is, it is, Ferrari is by far the biggest producer, and they are definitely putting the most money into championing the region and getting other people to recognize Trent. It's Trentadoc, by the way. This is always a little bit confusing to me. Trento is the region, but we call it Trentadoc, Trento DOC, because that's the, you know, DOC, just like we see it anywhere else in Italy. But it is, you know, it is such a special region. They're not terribly far from each other when you look at Franciacorta and Trentadoc, but they do make very different wines. You just have to think of them as like Franciacorta to me is like a little softer. And I find that like the Trentadoc wines, because they're at such high elevation, they tend to be a little zippier, a little brighter, definitely lean more into the acidity. So if you want, you know, different styles of champagne adjacent sparkling, those are definitely two regions to look to in Italy. Outside of Italy, you can, of course, go to Spain and look at cava. They are a different quality. I think there's some great cavas being produced, but it's different grapes. They are still made in the champagne method, but I find cava is like, it's not Prosecco adjacent, but I do treat it in a similar way when I don't want something that I want to have to think about too much, unless we're talking about like a super special cuvée, but where do you feel like cava slots in?
So cava has done a good job of trying to keep the quality high while also letting people, you know, they've allowed production outside of the northwest, the northeast rather, not specifically in Catalonia. So doing that and allowing the region to grow is something that could be scary. And I think that's really what happened when the Corpinat organization kind of came out of that energy. But cava itself can be a $9.99 on the shelf wine, or it can be an $80 retail lees aged, you know, single vintage wine. There's an amazing range of what you can find there now from the kind of mindset of production. I was an ambassador for a while for Codornu Reventos, and I got to know a lot of what they did. I love what they do. A small producer called Hane Ventura, I've been a big fan of for a long time. The Mionetto family is part of Freixenet and their whole kind of conglomerate they have going on.
Sigura Vidas,
exactly. Yeah. So there's some really incredible wines being made there. And I think the Spanish style, the Spanish lifestyle in general, calls for a lot of sparkling wine with the seafood heavy,
totally.
Especially Catalonia, Costa Brava, whether you're, you know, in Barcelona or whether you're also up in the Basque country near to the ocean, whether it be in Bilbao or San Sebastian. Cava makes sense in a lot of contexts with food there. And it's one of the most gastronomic places on the planet. I don't like going on record and saying favorites. That's not a term I love, but food in Spain, it's kind of hard to beat.
And especially like if you think about the food and like, and if that's the decision that you're making, like if you're between Prosecco or Franciacorta or Cava, like just consider what you're eating and like the regions that these places represent, right? That should lend itself to your decision. Like, are you going to be on the water? Then it probably should be Prosecco. Are you eating lots of like seafood? Are you eating very like Spanish cheeses? Then it probably should be cava. And then the last place we have to talk about, you know, obviously there's tons of domestic sparkling, right?
Yeah.
Domestic meaning California, Oregon, even Washington, and then Australian and Tasmanian sparkling, which we're not going to have a second to talk about today.
Next
but hopefully
time.
We'll have like another whole episode to talk about maybe New World sparkling. Yeah, maybe I should have titled this like anything but champagne, but also in Europe. Outside of champagne, you have all of the regions of champagne who produce what's called
Cremant,
which is always confusing because there is a region in Champagne called Cremant, but it's C-R-A-M-A-N-T, not C-R-E-M-A-N-T. But this is a great hack in life, right? If you're looking for a great bottle of sparkling wine, Cremant de the region. So Cremant de Loire, Cremant de Bordeaux, Cremant de Bas-Lemieux.
Alsace.
We love Alsace. These are all great places to look to for sparkling wine that is a fraction of the price of champagne and made with the grapes that are from that particular region. So always a good hack in life. There's tons of them on Wine Access. Do you have any favorite producers of Cremant from any particular region?
So from the Loire, I love Arnaud Lambert and all the Brezé wines from Samour. Big fan. I'm an ambassador also for Alsace. If there's any professionals who are going to be in New York next Monday, hit me up in the DMs. You're going to see this week. So hit me up quickly. Come to our Alsace Rocks tasting and I'll help you see amazing Cremant d'Alsace. Alamat Lagner, big fan of their rosé, one of the all-time producers. I haven't been to Lemieux specifically. I've been to the Languedoc a few times, but we made a TV show about sparkling wine with Somme TV a few years ago. And we had this great producer who also, of course, Domaine de la Fête.
Oh, I know. I love Domaine de la Fête. Wine Access featured it. I have a couple of bottles from them, both the rosé and their Brut. Fantastic Cremant producer.
Yeah.
Also, shout out to Langlois, which is the Bollinger affiliate in the Cremant de Loire. Some really, really great ones. You can find lots of them on Wine Access. This Lambrusco keeps getting more delicious and the weather keeps looking like it's getting warmer. So I'm going to go ahead and order a hoagie because I am from Philly.
Good call.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. I'm telling you, salty meats and Lambrusco or pizza, like this is where it's at. It's hard to go wrong. This is one that I stock up on for the summer. I love the Medici Amarte producer as well. There's some great ones all over Lambrusco, all over Emilia-Romagna that you can find. You just have to do a little research, and I am sorry about that. This is not the easiest category to navigate, but I think between Matthew and I, hopefully we can make it a little easier for you guys. Matthew, thank you so much for joining and for popping a cork on something delicious with me.
Pleasure.
I hope that our paths cross again in some other beautiful, delicious country, and then we get to share lots of meals and glasses of sparkling together. Where can the people find you?
You guys can find me on Instagram, LinkedIn, X, Facebook, Threads, in Los Angeles, on an airplane. Find me anywhere at Matthew J. Kaner. And if you would like to read the words that I put out daily, mensjournal.com/wine. Please and thank you.
I love it. I love it. Thanks for doing all the work that you're doing. And thank you guys for listening and joining us. Once again, if you are not a member of the Wine Club, you can do so by joining below. It's $120. You get 4 bottles every other month. I pick them. Shipping is included. Tax is not. But then you also get 10% off of all of your Wine Access purchases. So if you're thinking about stocking up on things like Cremant or Lambrusco, you could probably do some grill math there. You could probably make it so that if you bought enough, this would all make it worth it, right? Just joining the Wine Club. So just a little nudge for you guys. All right. Enjoy this warm weather that's finally landing and hopefully sticking this time. And Matthew, I'll catch you later. Cheers.
It's a pleasure. Spring has sprung. Let's go. Drink more Lambrusco.
Let's do it.